morning, everyone. Welcome back to today's virtual Board of Public Works meeting. As you all know, we started this with the coronavirus pandemic and making sure that we're all exercising physical distance. I don't want to say social distance because we're still sociable, just physically distant. But I do want to give a quick update from the Department of Health with regard to cases of coronavirus in the state of Maryland. We are now up to 54,982 cases. That's an increase of 807 positive diagnoses since yesterday, or I should say through yesterday. Unfortunately, we've had 45 additional fatalities, and that raises that total of confirmed deaths associated with COVID-19 to 2,519. As been reported earlier, we greatly increased our testing capacity and are pleased to see a consistent downward trend with regard to hospitalizations. Since April 30th, overall COVID-related hospitalizations are down 35%. And a decrease in ICU patients of 20%. And so I don't want these encouraging statistics to change the perspective. Now we understand, and I think most people remember that in early April and late March, we were facing a dire picture. There were projections and models that were showing that we might see 4,100 or more deaths in the state, and that we needed 6,000 beds, additional hospital beds, and close to 1,800 ventilators. And as you remember, we were at that time witnessing what was going on in New York City and what was happening in Italy, and the data was suggesting that we were just a couple of weeks behind those places. Now, fortunately, thanks to the determination of our fellow Marylanders, and, of course, the grit of our first frontline healthcare workers, we've been able to flatten that curve. And so we're in a position that we can begin to, reopen the state slowly and cautiously to get people back to work, get production going, and get back to some, maybe a new form of normal, at least for a period of time. Now, unfortunately, America has witnessed the tragic murder of George Floyd to the hands of a Minneapolis police officer. And like the rest of the country, I watched over the course of the past weekend where thousands of people came together to protest that senseless killing and the racism that even now in 2020 exists just under the surface in many institutions, and in some that are meant to protect American citizens, just as it is in the larger society. But I want to be clear that I have the utmost respect for our honorable men and women in law enforcement who go to work every day to serve and protect our communities. A few fortunate, I feel fortunate, I should say, to count a number of these men and women as friends as well as family members. And in my position as Lieutenant Governor, I have the privilege, the immense privilege, of having some dedicated state troopers from the Maryland State Police that protect me. And I'm incredibly grateful to them, not only for their service to the state and to me, but also the positive relationship and the friendships that we've developed that we enjoy not only between myself and them, but also my family and their families as well. Unfortunately, though, there are too many men and women across the country that look just like me, who instead of feeling safe and protected when they see a law enforcement officer, they feel anxious and in some cases afraid. And while I know that there are thousands of hardworking and dedicated and caring law enforcement officers across the country doing great things in their communities every day, that positive work can be overshadowed in an instance by those who will abuse their power and authority that they had received by having a badge and a uniform. So as said earlier this week, I stand with every man and woman across this great nation who has condemned the indefensible murder of George Floyd and any innocent people who have died at the hands of such injustice. In so many ways, we're at a turning point in our nation, unlike any that we've experienced before, or at least in my lifetime. And it is time for all of us, no matter what our race, age, gender, or creed is, to look deeply within ourselves, to acknowledge that there's work to be done, work that must be done, so that our nation may finally live up to the ideals of our founding and ensure life and liberty for every American once and for all. Now, as most people know, I was born in Washington, D.C., only 3 years after Brown versus Board of Education and the Bowling decision. I was raised there, and in my early years, segregation was still common. As a teenager, I experienced disparate treatment at the hands of law enforcement. I would say not necessarily with D.C. police, but in Prince George's County. And it was common in those days, and we were all told that if you were responding or had to deal with the Prince George's County police, you had to be extremely careful, particularly venturing into the county and coming from D.C. I was a freshman in Boston during the expanded Phase 1 busing at the time when the iconic photo was taken of the African-American lawyer who was attacked with the staff of the American flag. And I was told by a Bostonian roommate of mine that I could not go to South Boston or East Boston after dark, which I just thought was, I just could not understand it. I remember another guy from Philly was sitting in the room with us, and he and I were like, what do you mean? I can't go to a certain portion of town. And it was, it was just, shocking to me. And so believe me when I say that I'm not a stranger to discrimination and racism, and examples of, the failure of the ideology or ideals of our founding. But just as I condemn, as strongly as possible, the murder of George Floyd, and too many others, I also condemn those who will use this time of pain in our community to spread violence and destruction, and overshadowing the legitimate peaceful protests that communities who for far too long have been denied fundamental rights are, it takes away from the legitimate protests and demonstrations. Nevertheless, I do want to praise our Marylanders, our fellow Marylanders, who have expressed their rights to protest in a peaceful manner. I'm particularly proud of the young people who organized Monday's huge protests, and peaceful protests, I should say, in Baltimore City, and the young people who did the very same thing for a very successful and huge protest in Columbia, Maryland just yesterday. And there were several smaller protests that happened around the state that were equally as successful and examples for the rest of the country. I especially want to commend those members of the Baltimore community and members of the Baltimore City Police Department who worked together to calm the crowds on Monday night in Baltimore. It was great to see where some of the demonstrators identified and turned into the police a non-resident who had thrown a firework at the police line. So I hope Maryland can continue to be a model for the country on how you can protest and demonstrate and express your concerns in a peaceful manner and not allow, outside agitators to take over or hijack the message that we're trying to send. Lastly, yesterday was primary day in Maryland. There were reports of several challenges associated with it. There is some information that's coming out today with regard to some challenges in Baltimore City. I have not had a chance to review it, but something with regard to the ballots in the first Councilmatic District. That is just another example of the challenges that have been occurring with the State Board of Elections. And I did say earlier in a radio interview that I really think it's time for the administrator at the Board of Elections to step down. I think it's time for new leadership there, and to be done early, before we, with enough time to correct all of these issues before we get to November's general election. And so I call on the Senate to work with us to find new leadership, and I encourage the administrator to step down. That's it. I'd like to turn it over to Treasurer Kopp for opening remarks. Thanks.
Thank you, Governor. I must say that I, like millions of others, watched the video last week, something I had never seen before. A policeman forcing his knee between the shoulder and the head of a man whom he forced lying down on the ground, and doing it for more than 8 minutes until the man died. Never in my life would I think to see such a thing. And other policemen standing around watching him. This simply can't happen in America. And I must say, I took part in a large number of protests 50 years ago, 40 years ago. I'm embarrassed and ashamed that I didn't continue doing it. This is not America, and I think we know that. I agree completely that the majority of our law enforcement officers are honest and good and don't like it any more than we do. After all, they are being fingered as bad guys because of the rotten apples among them. Mm-hmm. They've got to be stopped. It's got to be stopped, and I'm very pleased that the legislature and as our legislatures across the country taking up the project immediately of looking at our laws and seeing what have to be changed in order to hold people with such power accountable to the people. Protest is a wonderful American institution. To hear the President of the United States apparently regarded as the next thing to insurrection and revolution is frightening and wrong. And I think the state of Maryland thus far has shown that to him. I'm very proud of the way the governor has spoken to the people of Maryland and look forward to hearing him speak to the president with the same words that he uses when he speaks here, stressing the importance of protest, the legitimacy and justice of the concerns, and the resolution to correct them now. I trust everyone agrees with me. Everyone in this room I know does. And I think the vast proportion of Americans of all colors and all religions agree with this. And we have to stand up and say so right now. Having said that, I can't think of anything more important except to say good morning to you both.
Thank you very much. Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and thank you, Madam Treasurer. I couldn't be prouder to associate myself with the remarks of both of you, and thank you for making those statements. Obviously, the senseless death of George Floyd underscores that our nation continues to have a cancerous system of injustice and oppression, a system that has plagued African Americans in the United States for centuries. But of course, George Floyd isn't the first African American to be murdered by officers of the law, who swore an oath to protect all the citizens. There was Freddie Gray. There was Philando Castile. There was Walter Scott. There was Eric Garner. So many others whose unjustified deaths have marked sad chapters in our nation's history. And regret, absent of real and meaningful reforms, we're not going to see an end to these senseless deaths anytime soon. The anger that has erupted across this country and, yes, across the world is a loud and forceful repudiation of a society that continues to deprive African Americans and people of color with equal justice under the law. The fact that to this day African Americans continue to experience racial profiling, are arrested illegally, abused, and in some tragic cases killed, contradicts the values and principles of our nation. It is truly un-American. The injustice and inequality cannot and must not continue. Obviously, we must all play an active role in this most critical endeavor. Millions of Americans, as the Treasurer and the Lieutenant Governor mentioned, have engaged in peaceful protests to demand action from the government they empower to cure the societal ailments that continue to divide our nation. And these ailments inspire racism and bigotry against our fellow citizens. So I want to just follow the Lieutenant Governor and compliment, and the Treasurer complimenting Governor Hogan, but also the people of the state of Maryland, where thousands have participated in marches, some of them led by children, this past Monday. The people who protested in Baltimore and in cities across Maryland and the United States, they're crying out and demanding action from their leaders. We obviously need to listen, and we need to act. And I salute Treasurer Cobb for mentioning the actions of our legislature, also the Congress. According to Speaker Pelosi this morning, has a full agenda to begin to address some of this. But like everyone else, what we saw in Lafayette Square outside the White House on Monday, June 1st, the evening, still light, still daylight, that has to be marked down in America's political history as such a degradation of the presidency and a flagrant abuse of power. Tear gassing peaceful demonstrators, firing rubber bullets, setting off flash bang grenades, having federal law enforcement on large horses looking like some kind of cavalry, so that the President of the United States could have a photo op in front of the church. That's pretty unprecedented. In a time when our economy is crashing, when tens of millions of Americans are unemployed as we speak, when over 107,000 people have perished from a deadly pandemic, when there are riots, looting dozens of cities around the country, when there's innocent, commendable protest against police brutality all over the country, how exactly is this being described as making America great again? Just mention that again. 107,000 people dead. 40 million Americans unemployed. Police brutality all over the front pages. And looting and burning in our major cities. So, obviously, the fight for justice and equality is going to continue. Obviously, the president has done nothing but fan the flames of racism and bigotry and hatred. He's repeatedly abdicated the responsibilities of his office. Happens to be, in my opinion, an embarrassment to the presidency of the nation at this point. And I would also include the Attorney General, the Secretary of Defense, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I would remind them that a very similar historic incident, comparable to June 1st, tear gassing of innocent peaceful demonstrators, occurred in 1932, in July of 1932, when 17,000 veterans and 27,000 members of their family were camped out in Anacostia, petitioning the Congress to give them their back pay. President Hoover, who was then heavily predicted to be reelected in the fall election, decided to be super tough. He called General Douglas MacArthur, the chief of staff of the Army, and ordered him to clear out the veterans. And they proceeded with tanks, U.S. Army soldiers with bayonets on, tear gas, arrested hundreds, injured hundreds, drove all of the veterans away from their encampment and burned all of their possessions. For several days after that, President Hoover really strutted around like a peacock, according to the press, claiming how tough he is on law and order. Guess what? Disastrous consequences for President Hoover at the polls that November. Just a complete wipeout for that kind of policy where U.S. Army troops were authorized to attack fellow veterans. So, I don't mean to go back to 1932, but I would suggest to folks that are walking around now thumping their chests saying how tough they are, they really should look at history a little bit, because the American public, as Lieutenant Governor and the Treasurer have noted, and frankly, people at all levels of government, support constitutional rights to protest and demand action and systemic reforms. And I think we are going to collectively rise to the occasion once and for all to enact policies that are going to deliver justice, equality, and fairness. But I would urge folks that think everything is just great to go out and, you know, pound innocent people with these horrible weapons. And I guess apparently they're calling these pepper bullets, not tear gas. Hey, I'd love to see one of them hit with a pepper bullet and see what their response is. And these were innocent people, as I say, perfectly orderly and peaceful. And the fact that the Attorney General is involved in this and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was dressed in camouflage and went over across the street, stood in front of a church, hijacked it, held up this prop of a Bible, apparently upside down. But the fact that the Secretary of Defense and the AG and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would participate in this kind of charade is just very regrettable. But as 1932 showed, we always have redress, thank goodness, in the United States. And sorry to go on, guys, but boy, has this really touched a nerve, I think, in the public.
That's quite a bit. It's, you know, I didn't go back to 1932. I wasn't around there. I don't think you were around there either. But and I know it's not the same situation, but the images reminded me of Kent State, frankly. You know, and I know that was far worse because there were fatalities there. But it just that came to mind. When I saw that.
Well, I think we're all, I hope you're right about a change. But I think we all still have to be on guard in the near and immediate future. Because the president has made it clear he wants to take over. He wants the military to go into the states. I mean, this is not going to disappear tomorrow. Well, thank you. Absolutely was. Well, but I'm happy to
step up and continue to speak. Thank you. I guess we have the Secretary's agenda, John Comptroller.
Yes, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 12 items on the Secretary's agenda and 80 reports of emergency procurement. Emergency reports A4, A5, A19. Have been revised. Item A19, sub-item 4 is being withdrawn at the request of the submitting agency. Happy to assist with answering any questions.
Well, I still have some questions about A19. So I'm pleased to hear that.
This item four, the one portion, that one award that's being withdrawn by the agency this time.
Madam Treasurer, you want to ask a question or questions?
I'm sorry. I'm having, as I told you, Jonathan. I'm having a great deal of difficulty with reception here, and I apologize. Don't know what exactly I can do about it.
One thing you could possibly do, if it's just audio, like I did on one occasion, is take the audio over the phone. John, I don't know if that's something we can do now.
It is a possibility, Madam Treasurer. If the audio is clear, if you can hear us, we can certainly hear you clearly for the most part. So if you want to continue talking...
The point is I can't hear you.
You cannot hear us. Okay.
Clearly. So why don't somebody else talk for a while, then I'll call in.
One possibility, Madam Treasurer, is to turn off if you have a device near your computer. So if you have a cell phone or another laptop.
Okay. I don't.
I have some questions on other items. Would be happy to...
yes, please.
Fill in until Treasurer is all comfortable with her version there. So,
Thank you.
Agenda item A1 is emergency procurement for the acquisition of 30,000 reagent kits and other items for COVID-19 test kits to be operational and deployed. Obviously, I appreciate Governor Hogan and his very commendable decision to decide to try to expand testing across the state. I guess the question from a fiscal standpoint is, have the reagent kits arrived? Have they been utilized? Has the department been able to acquire more reagent kits? And I understand this is intimately connected to our ability to
I believe
test people, and we have seen a significant rise in the bill. Excuse me? So how many test kits have they made available to the county? I'm not sure if we have that information.
Mr. Comptroller, we have Secretary Dembro, the Director of Procurement at the Department of Health, available to answer questions about this item.
Oh, good. Delegate Dembro, someone that I like a lot. Where are you?
Dana?
Mr. Controller, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, I'm sorry I was muted there for a couple of seconds. For the record, this is Dana Dembro, Director of the Office of Procurement and Support Services of the Maryland Department of Health. Today's meeting is unprecedented with so many emergency procurements for you to review that my role today will be a little unusual in that we have nearly 20 presenters on the WebEx line ready to respond to your questions. So I will mostly be just introducing them. If you'll indulge me for just a moment, I want to thank all of them for their extraordinary work and let you know that they represent only a small fraction of the innumerable dedicated public servants in the executive branch, not only at the Department of Health, but also at the Office of Procurement of the Department of General Services and other agencies, who leapt into action 10 weeks ago and accomplished all of the emergency work that you see presented to you today, marking Maryland as the envy of other states in our coronavirus response efforts. With respect to item number A1, we have on the line the Director of the Maryland Laboratories Administration, Dr. Robert Myers.
Mr. Dembro, just for the future, I understand you're calling in by phone. If you can mute your computer's audio and you can still listen to the meeting through your phone line, we're getting some echo on the line.
I'm not calling in on my phone. I'm on the computer, just so you know.
Okay.
John, I think it might be me. I've got my phone on now. Do I turn off?
So, Madam Treasurer, you can use your phone. If you've entered the audio pin under the audio tab on the control panel on the right side of your screen, you'll see a pin for you to enter. Once you've entered the pin and hit the pound sign, you'll be able to use your phone's audio, and you can turn off your computer's audio, and you'll be linked into the meeting.
Hello, I'm Robert Myers. I'm the director of the Maryland Department of Health Laboratories Administration. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Yes, to explain what these purchase was about, we ran into supply chain issues early on during the pandemic that the CDC-based test that we were running, we could not increase our testing capacity. Abbott Laboratories had testing reagents available that were compatible with an existing automated testing platform that we have at the MDH laboratory. So we purchased these test reagents so that we could increase our testing capacity, and it's been implemented. All 30,000 test reagents have been received. They're being utilized almost on a daily basis at the MDH lab to produce test results for clients throughout the state, including the local health department. Approximately, I'd say 20% to 30% of our daily workload is pushed through this Abbott system. So it really was another testing platform to increase the capacity of the MDH lab to perform COVID-19 PCR-based testing. And I'm here to answer any other questions.
Well, let me just add a couple of questions on different items here. I completely understand the emergency situation that was created, frankly, in my opinion, by the federal government not properly stockpiling the type of equipment that the states needed in order to do testing and contact follow-up, et cetera. So this is not, I'm not critical of the agency, nor am I critical necessarily of the governor. I'm just trying on behalf of the taxpayers to understand how many reagent kits have actually arrived, how many have been utilized, have we been able to acquire new reagent kits, and are we within the market rates of what these items typically cost, or do we have to pay a premium because of the fact that we were competing against all the other states and countries around the world?
Mr. Comptroller, the pricing was standardized pretty much across the United States on this. I don't think the companies were marking up. We had a previous business relationship with Abbott. Their instrument was used in our laboratory for many years for doing HIV viral load testing. So we were told by HHS that this was a way to increase our capacity and overcome some of our supply chain issues. All 30,000 test reagents have been received. They have a fairly long expiration date. I'd say on a given day, about 200 tests are pushed through this system with the current staffing that we have. We intend to increase our staffing and run a third shift overnight and then be able to use the system even more to produce up to maybe 400 tests per day. I can't give you an exact number of how many of those test kits have been utilized, but we have had this test on board for about 30 days. And as I said before, it's used consistently. It's allowed us to leverage different people in the laboratory who can operate that test system independent of the other test systems and the other staffing that we have. So it has been beneficial for us to increase our testing capacity. If we have the need to be resupplied for this, I think we would go out and again request additional procurement. But at the present time, we have an adequate supply to take us through the next several months. We don't want to be stuck with reagents that, if our testing numbers were to decrease, that we would not want to have reagents that would expire on our hands and would be unusable. We do have the ability, and we've been told that Abbott has adequate production capability to keep most of the state labs that have these particular instruments supplied into the immediate future.
Okay, and thank you for that. That makes sense. Before I turn it back to the treasurer, who I see is rejoining us, Madam Treasurer, by the way, there but for fortune go me. as far as figuring out the technology we're all using. But if I could ask the doctor just quickly, because the item two is about contact tracing. Is that something you're informed about as far as how we're doing?
Yes, sir. That would be the epidemiologist from MDH. I'm the laboratory portion. We actually physically perform the test, but we're not involved in the tracing of contacts.
Okay, well, let me hand it back, Governor, to you, and I'll ask my question to the right person after the treasurer.
Okay. Yeah, I think Vicki Fretwell is from the Department of Health. She's going to answer the contact tracing call for information. I don't know if you want to wait until the
treasurer.
No,
I'm
happy to go to
So if I may introduce Vicki, Lieutenant Governor, she's the Special Assistant and Senior Advisor to the Secretary, and she can talk about the contract with the National Opinion Research Center based out of the University of Chicago, one of the world's most famous academic institutions, as the Treasurer will testify. We also have Jeff Dougherty on the line. He's Deputy Director of the Population Health Administration, and they can talk about the NORC contract contact tracing.
Okay, so this is item A2. If you could just help me understand how many total contacts have been made in Maryland and cases handled by the contact tracing call center. It sounds as if we're ramping up the center. What is the future hold as far as contact testing, I guess?
So thank you for that question. We started a soft launch with Baltimore City and NORC on Monday with 20 callers. Yesterday we had 50 callers, and today we have increased that number. Through yesterday, we did 823 outbound calls on 225 cases and identified, 312 cases and identified 225 contacts. Each day this week, we'll be ramping up. We'll be adding later in the week half of the health department, local health departments, and their contact tracers one day, and then the subsequent day, the other half of the health departments and their contact tracers. And when the full deployment is done, we'll have 1,325 contact tracers, 1,395 contact tracers active in the system. Our anticipation is we will have no less than 1,000 cases handled on a daily basis.
Excellent. I have one other item, Lieutenant Governor, same line, and it may be this individual or someone, Delegate Dembrough, wants
could,
to respond.
Could I, excuse me,
just ask a question of Vicki of number two still. Are you hearing an echo?
Yes, Madam Treasurer. Mute your computer's audio.
I'm not using the computer, so
you can't hear us through your computer, you can only hear us through your phone.
Madam Treasurer, we can determine what you're saying, even though there is an echo.
Okay. The question, well, I think highly of NORC, is why are they worth $8 million more?
Madam Secretary, when the group of us that were evaluating the contracts that had been submitted and then making recommendations to leadership at both DOIT and the Maryland Department of Health, we felt strongly that we needed to have a partner that had significant experience in public health, had a long history of doing this type of calling, and would be a successful partner for us. The contract at its core is a unit price of $192 per case they investigate. The $34,500,000 would be the full price should we do 180,000 contact tracing through them during the 6 month period. That helpful?
Yes, that is helpful. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Mr. Comptroller, did you have another question about contact tracing?
No, I didn't, but I had one last item, numbers A6, before the, I'm sure the treasurer has something to offer, 19, I think, but,
this is also, Mr. Denbrough.
Yeah, so this is the Maryland VEEP program where we've changed them, thank goodness, from emissions testing, which is one of the all-time aggravations of Maryland citizens I sympathize with, since I have to take my cars up there also. And they're old, et cetera. But anyway, that's been suspended, and we are now using the VEEP facilities for drive-through testing, which obviously is something very successfully done by South Korea to aggressively test their citizens, which I think has contributed to a much different experience over in South Korea with coronavirus than we have here in the States. So I guess the question, Delegate Denbrough, is can you tell us how many tests have been conducted at the state emissions VEEP facilities?
Is Webster you on?
I'm sorry. Item A6 is the Maryland Partnership for Prevention staffing at the VEEP stations. And to answer those questions, Dr. Jinling Chan is available. She's the Assistant Secretary of the Department of Health.
Excellent.
Hi, good morning, Comptroller, Lieutenant Governor, and Treasurer Kopp. This is Jolene Chan with the Maryland Department of Health. Thank you for your question, Comptroller. So to date, we have about 13,560 tests that have been conducted at the VEEP locations. We have about 9 VEEP locations open and operational across the state right now, and they are variably staffed by local health departments, as well as some of the MCP staff.
And if I could just follow up, there's some confusion among folks in Maryland as to whether you need a doctor's prescription or whether you need an appointment or whether you need some other characteristic that may or may not be present. And what about just allowing people to drive up and get tested as opposed to making them make a grant application?
So the VEEP locations are able to accept orders through the CRISP process and make appointments through that process. For many of the VEEP locations, they're not in neighborhoods that may always be able to accommodate traffic, and so we've been cautious in terms of neighbor relations and traffic control and safety issues as well to ensure that people can get their tests safely. We are looking at ways to open up that testing and access to it across the state, whether it's in VEEP locations or other locations such as Six Flags and Intimonium, where they are able to handle the greater volume and the capacity in those locations. So we are trying to expand access in different ways as well.
Okay, let me just suggest something, because I, like a lot of grandparents in the state of Maryland, unable to see my grandkids, A, because of the travel problems, and also because of concern that either we would infect them or they would infect us. So I'm going to see my grandkids in July. That's pretty definite. I've asked my kids and to have their kids tested. I would like to be tested with my wife. I have no medical reason why I should be tested. I'm certainly not going to ask to be tested because I'm the comptroller, but I do think there ought to be some system set up in the state somewhere where people go to get tested simply asymptomatically and voluntarily. I'm not exactly sure whether we're going to ever get to that point, but what do you think?
Let me interrupt. Dr. Chan, we have that now. Six Flags is available on demand. And as you mentioned, Timonium is on demand. Some of the VEEP stations can handle, but they just, when we first announced it, they really couldn't handle that volume, and it backed up communities. And so we've suggested for many of the VEEP stations that you make an appointment, but you don't have to have a doctor's note or anything. If you make the appointment, you can go through much quicker and not stand in lines. But with Six Flags and the Timonium Fairgrounds, we have much more space. So it is on demand right now.
I didn't realize that. So that's terrific. I'm very pleased to hear that.
And CVS is rolling out more locations also that you can go to CVS at no charge as well, and they don't need a doctor's note for CVS. Now, I believe we put up some of those locations on the Department of Health's website that CVS has already opened up. And as I understand, what I was told this morning, there are going to be additional CVS locations opened up for testing as well.
Thank you. And if the staff could just confirm that, in fact, CVS and others are not putting people through an application process, I would be grateful. I understand what you're saying about the appointments. That kind of makes sense. All I'm suggesting is cutting through some of the red tape here is important.
You want to make it as easy. Yeah, you want to make it as easy as possible, and we agree with you.
That's all I'm suggesting. Madam Treasurer, I'm sorry.
Thank you, and thank you,
Follow up on your point, Governor.
Sounds worse than it was.
Sorry.
It's good to hear you multiple times.
No. At least this isn't multiple. Can you hear me at all?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Very good.
We'll try this one again. The drive-in and the easy access made me think about a lot of people who don't have access to either cars, so the V isn't so accessible. And the question is, are we making a particular point of trying to locate these alternatives, the CVS or whatever it is, where people actually can reach them? There are many areas that are, just as they're food deserts, they're also
right.
CVS deserts.
And that's why, the CVS is one because they tend to be, located throughout the state. And, in some cases, people can walk up or get there through public transit. When the Pimlico State facility that has been open in Baltimore was also taking walk-ups, and I know at least one of the CVS in Baltimore, I think on Charles Street, is taking people. But we can get more information to you all with regard to locations where you don't necessarily have to have a drive to get there. And I think we'll work with the health department and get that information to the board.
That would be great. I mean, I think the V stations are terrific and can really accomplish a lot, but there remains a lot.
Madam Treasurer, if I could just add on, I hope Lieutenant Governor, this is given in a positive tone here. I hope the troops at the on the front lines, the CVS personnel, for example, don't feel as if they have to interrogate people who want to test. Because right now, when you go, you don't need a doctor's prescription, you're right. But as of yesterday, there was a question as to whether you needed to have symptoms or whether you had to have this or that. So I understand people don't want to just willy-nilly give tests, and they don't want to be overwhelmed. But I hope that the word gets out to the troops at the front of this process that if somebody wants a test, they should give them the test.
Yeah. Well, at least the order from the governor was that anyone, because we were looking for those asymptomatic individuals, the testing that we've done at the nursing homes have produced some asymptomatic staff members that, they weren't showing any symptoms, but by doing the universal testing at the nursing homes, we're starting to find staff members who have the coronavirus, but for whatever reason, they're not showing symptoms. But they can pass it on to those people who are most vulnerable. And so that is the reason for, the expanded testing as well, is to be able to get the asymptomatic person who's not showing signs, and they may only show mild symptoms at some point, but they are infectious. They can infect others. And so, yes, we can make sure that I know the governor's had conversations with the president of CVS, and we can see what contacts they have to make sure that, you know, they're not discouraging people from coming. It is a balance. We want people to go if not only if they have symptoms, but if they think that they come in contact, or like in your case that you want to visit, you know, your grandchildren, but you don't want to be in a situation where you're infecting them.
Thank you. I think that would be very helpful.
This country, you know, you're gonna.
Oh no, we're right now we're talking about driving, but you know, everybody's kind of asking everyone else what it's like. So we'll see. This is not going to be till next month. But I don't mean to inject myself. Whenever I mention testing, people say, well, you're the comptroller. You can go and get a test anytime you want to. Well, yeah, perhaps that's the case. But the point is, ordinary people need to be treated carefully by the folks that are on the ground. And sometimes they, you know, well-intentionally steer people away, I think, still. So anything you can do, Lieutenant Governor, to just reinforce the governor's executive order would be great.
Yeah. Bedside manner, as they used to say, right?
Exactly.
Governor, one of the questions I was going to ask when my computer went strange on me, with the testing, with the contact tracing, was that maybe you could get the department to just summarize, not now, come back, what the process is for contact tracing and how they observe appropriate privacy issues.
To get that to you, Madam Treasurer. This is Vicki. I'll be happy to get something to you.
Terrific. Thank you. I do have a question about 19 to get back to where we were 20 minutes ago. I understand number 4, which is the one that has raised the issue in the press, has been removed from the list to find out more about it, I assume.
Correct. I can't speak to the reason for its withdrawal, but Madam Treasurer, that SI item has been withdrawn. Item 19 is a report of 81, now 80 emergency procurements by the Department of General Services. We have Secretary Churchill, along with Danny Mays and Mike Hafley available to answer questions.
Thank you. A question about number 4, because when questions were raised about it, we went to look at our files in the treasurer's office, the financial, as you know, a department puts out a purchase order, they send the invoices to the comptroller's office. The comptroller's office looks at them and warrants an expenditure from the treasurer's office. Am I getting through? I'm hearing this terrible sound.
Yeah, it's a beeping, but I'm hearing you, but there's something happening.
Did you hear it as well, Madam Treasurer? Maybe good now. To correct the record, there's 80 emergency procurements total. Now, this item 19 contains 63, or did, and now contains 62.
Okay. My point was, we went back to the...
My apologies, Madam Treasurer. Is your phone line still active?
No, I went back to the computer.
Well, you sound fine now, so carry on.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Comptroller. I went back to look at these papers, and to tell you the truth, we did not find the name Coast to Coast Strategies anywhere except on this item, on this document before us, the board meeting. Not on the envelope voices, not on the warrants, not anywhere. So I was going to raise a question about that. And then I noticed the Food Door Pharma right above it, total price $2.4 million. I believe that that is correct, but originally it was significantly more than that.
It
was pulled back, and Mr. Secretary,
the contract if it was there.
You said you would try with 2.489 to get the ventilators that were needed, and I gather that's what's recorded here, but the original procurement isn't recorded here.
Mr. Gideon, I believe your microphone is active, sir.
The funds were sent out. It was aware. It was then recovered. My question is, I don't have the background information, the purchase order, the actual expenditures on all of these items. You know it's only 60-something items, Mr. Gontram. But until we have that sort of information, I am not comfortable with this chart. I know that the Department of Treasury, the Federal Department of Treasury and OMB are talking about turning many of these CARES expenditures into items susceptible to the federal single audit. These are going to be audited at some point, but it seems to me before the Board of Public Works approves them, before the federal government audits them, we ought to have a file that contains the entire information for all of these emergency procurements, and we don't have that. And since there are only 60-something, it seems to me it would not be that difficult to bring those all together. So I just want to say I'm very hesitant to vote for these until all the material is made public, because a couple of things have already raised issues, and we don't know enough about the others. What to say?
Could I follow up, because I happen to partially agree with the treasurer in her concern, and I'm not exactly sure what the remedy is, but we're spending obviously huge amounts of taxpayer money. And I understand the conditions, as I mentioned earlier, were forced upon us. It wasn't something we voluntarily assumed. But the question is, are we continuing to pay money? How much money are we continuing to pay? What are the fulfillment of the different contracts that are here? How many have been canceled? And what's being done to complete their orders? And then there's this group Blue Flame that I guess the treasurer was specifically asking about. I guess what I'm asking for is, or suggesting, is that I kind of sympathize with the state, Lieutenant Governor, your situation and the tremendous pressure that everyone had. But I'm wondering whether we could get tightened up here. Treasurer and I are concerned, I think, from a fiscal standpoint, that we're spending taxpayer dollars for contracts that, quite frankly, you know, or have some questions about them. So I wonder if we could provide the board with a biweekly update on the status of these emergency contracts, so we're not just presented with them at a given time, but we receive biweekly updated copies of the procurement report chart that was attached to this item, for example, that includes completion status and quantities delivered, and as the weeks progress, completed, obviously. So that's coming from me. That's a little different than the hesitation articulated by the treasurer, but I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
I guess I would turn to the secretary to see if that kind of information is available. But let me go back to just the treasurer. The treasurer is asking for additional, I guess, backup material. Like you said, if you want purchase orders, and there are a number of other items. And so that's a question that I would ask the secretary, if that information can be provided to the treasurer so that she can feel more comfortable.
Well, Governor, let me just say, I would like to see the information that I believe you have. I'm not doubting that you have it. But the information which allows these expenditures to be reconciled to the general ledger, which the comptroller's office keeps and all of the components that go into that. I'm sure that's what the federal audit is going to want to see, and it seems to me that the sooner we get it together and the more accustomed we are to providing this information and showing the reconciliation, the easier it will be for everyone in the long term.
Mr. Secretary?
Good morning to the board, Madam Treasurer, Governor, Mr. Comptroller. Concerning the questions that were asked in a number of parts, the department would not have an issue with supplying the POs to members of the board staff to understand, to help you understand the nature of any of the procurements. I cannot speak at this moment. I think I probably need to have a conversation concerning reconciling to the general ledger, just to make sure that we understand what that means in terms of documentation that is being looked at. I can tell you, because these are federal funds, that we are compiling information that would be in response to the federal requirements. So I don't believe we'll have an issue. I just need to fully understand the level of documentation that the board staff would need to move this item.
My question, I think you should not have difficulty doing, that there are folks in your office, the comptroller's office, the treasurer's office, who can, and obviously Board of Public Works, the head of procurement, provide necessary information and guidance.
Well, we have a full file for these are commodities releases.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I the team is fully equipped to answer your question. I just want to go back to the comptroller's the question about regular reporting on the progress. That's what we have attempted to do today, based on a date on your report of 6-1 in terms of progress, and we would be able to do that periodically to the board if that's what the board would like us to do. And then I want to clarify, because there's a couple of vendors on the report that have the word have blue in their title. I believe the treasurer was referring to Blue Door Pharma, which is a Maryland right. company, where right. We're asking about a purchase order that had been issued first, and he attempted a wire transfer, and that was not successful. And so that never formally hit our records. We pulled that back, but the official PO to Blue Door is represented, Blue Door Farm is represented on item 3. That's the materials that were contracted, and some of that has been returned.
And that's the sort of information, Mr. Secretary, that the sort of reconciliation I'm talking about would document.
And that's really the only transaction of that nature. You know, the other cancellations, they're noted, are fairly straightforward. Of course, item 61 is Blue Flame Medical, which is what I believe the comptroller may have been referring to, which is a contract that, or a PO that has been canceled with the vendor.
I'm not sure what the direction is that my colleagues wanted to, but if the secretary were to commit to submitting every 2 weeks updated copies of the procurement report chart that we have right now for these over the last few months, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money. I would be very happy if that were able to be delivered to us or committed to us. I'm not sure if I need a motion or just have Secretary Churchill agree to that. But I think the issue here is that we've come through a period where there was tremendous pressure on DGS
they have performed very, very capably, in my opinion, but, you know, it's $230 million and some question mark payments here. So I think it would be best if going on from here, we have every 2 weeks a status report. So the questions that the treasurer and I have could be answered in real time. I defer, of course, to the lieutenant governor and the treasurer as to whether they want to require that or how they would do it.
Let me ask a question, and this goes to both of you, the treasurer and the comptroller. I know the treasurer for the items that are before us today, additional background information on these procurements, these emergency procurements. Then to go to the 2 week, are we going to be providing within that 2 week, you know, the full background similar to what we're going to be providing for the 60 items in A19. So I don't know what the turnaround is for the Secretary of General Services, but we're going to, I guess, it appears as though, and the Treasurer hasn't made it an official motion, but I think it's going to be a motion to defer these items subject to coming back with more detailed information on the items, purchase orders, and the reconciliation on some of the items that the Treasurer may have some additional questions on.
My thought, Governor, is that we have these commodities and they're coming in. This is an emergency approval of what has been done.
Right.
As I understand it, it would not stop any masks that have been ordered and paid for from coming in if it were deferred for 2 weeks to allow you the opportunity to put all the material together and to set up a process so that your staff can make this material, the documents, appropriate for you as you send them on to us.
If I may clarify the options available to the board, Madam Treasurer, you're absolutely correct in the posture of these procurements. The standard items taken up by the board, as you all know, are recommendations that come for prospective actions by an agency, such as to award a contract or to disperse grant funding. These items are in a little bit of a different posture. So these are reports of emergency procurement actions already taken by agencies. The options in front of the board are to accept the report or to remand the report back to the agency. As we discussed at last meeting, under state procurement law, under CMAR 21050602, the board can take any action it deems appropriate with respect to the emergency procurement. So if the board wanted to accept the report or to remand the report with specific instructions, such as to return with additional information, that is absolutely within the authority of the board.
Well, I'd like to hear from the governor.
Well, what I was saying is, you know, let's take the remand approach, remanding it with the request for the additional information. Then in, let's say, 2 weeks, I think the next board meeting is 2 weeks, will that also include the comptroller's request for any additional items and then the detail, too? So that was the question, and then I was turning to General Services in terms of being able to provide, you know, the update as well as these 60 items and the full background information.
Well, there's a couple of things to consider as a part of this. In terms of updating this chart, yes, we can do that on a regular basis. It would require a great deal more for the department. Manpower of our procurement officers who are still engaged in procurement to put together the commodities background. And so the department may ask for more time to be able to assemble the information for the chart presently, which is procurement through April 26. We still have another emergency report for procurement after that date that have to be submitted. And so that is the current challenge that the department would have to fully comply. I have no doubt that we can meet the board's requirements. It's timing.
Well, let me just make it clear. The documents I'm talking about are the purchase orders and the invoices that come, that justify what comes before us when the comptroller warrants an expenditure and we print a check and he sends it out. That information should be readily at hand. It's not very difficult. And I would think because of the questions that have arisen, for instance, going back to one of these now that has 2.4 billion for a total price, the original disbursement from our office was over 9 billion. And then we put a hold on some of that. You wouldn't know that. And unless you had all the background material, you wouldn't know, although we do, and we don't disagree with you, know that the 2.4 is related to the 9.9, and somehow some of the money has, I trust, come back, just as I trust the Attorney General will be able to recoup some of the blue flame money. All of this, the documentation is simple, Mr. Secretary. It's not complicated and shouldn't take a lot of people. And I know you have the basic documents there, and the comptroller's office has theirs, and we have ours. So I don't think that we are asking for a huge amount of staff time. And that's why I feel pretty comfortable agreeing with the Lieutenant Governor that we should remand it, expect it in 2 weeks. If it can't be done, it can't be done. I understand that. But I'm not sure it will take as much time as you think it will. And I know that our staff, comptroller staff, Board of Public Works staff, are happy to work with your folk on this.
I think, Mr. Secretary, I think, you know, the question is, and at least my question would be, I would think that you could produce at least the 60 that are here in a 2 week period. And if you need more time for those that you were scheduling to bring to the next board, that you can put in a request before the board meeting saying that we're going to, you know, produce those additional ones, you know, at either the next board, or we'll get a status report to before the board meeting, but to the board members so they can see it before it comes to the board in the next meeting. So it may be 3 weeks, an additional week, to get those that come after this existing report. Does that almost make sense? It made sense to me, but I don't know how it sounded to everyone else, particularly Mr. Comptroller.
No, I'm happy as long as the information for the future reports are included, and happy to join with my colleagues and what the Lieutenant Governor and the Treasurer are talking about. Obviously, we're just protecting the taxpayers here. Obviously, we have some knowledge of the fact that everybody was working under extraordinary emergency conditions. It's all we're trying to do here, I think, not putting words in anyone's mouth. We're just trying to protect the taxpayers and do what is the right fiscal situation without getting into a lot of speculation, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And so I'm happy to do that as long as, you know, I have a lot of confidence in Secretary Churchill. I think all of the work that's been done has been basically done out of a well-intentioned, highly stressful period. I think things will now begin to hopefully calm down a little bit, but happy to have a unified front as far as making sure that our citizens are not getting defrauded in any way, I guess is the right way to put it.
Well, I will make a motion that this item is remanded. Great. With instructions to bring it back with the underlying documents that the treasurer had asked for. She explained it. It's in the record. That they come back in 2 weeks. You know, and of course, the information will be provided to the treasurer and comptroller's office, to the board, before it's actually the date, because it will be in the agenda. But that underlying information is brought back in 2 weeks. And then I would ask that the secretary explore what he can do with regard to the next round of emergencies, and if he's able to provide that information along with the information that is requested in this remand. Can provide it, to provide it if he needs additional time to notify the board how much time he's going to need to get those additional items in. So that, I think that motion, hopefully that motion was relatively clear.
I would second that. Thank you. And I think that, you know, is a clear non, let me just say, I think that's, from a fiscal standpoint, is the right thing to do, Lieutenant Governor. Thank you. Madam Treasurer.
It is. We have to make sure that we have, you know, all the I's dotted and T's crossed, because as the Treasurer rightfully said, either at the state level, or but definitely at the federal level, there's going to be a closer look at this. And particularly since we're going to be billing this to the federal government, they're going to make sure that this is done properly. So if we can, and, you know, for the credibility of the board, I think we do need to see as much information as possible. So with that said, I will ask, though, the and this isn't a motion, ask the secretary, are we seeing a decrease in the emergency procurements because these items are starting to come in? I know they come. The requests come in through WebOC. Are we getting less requests coming in through MEMA and the and their WebEOC?
I believe that requests are still coming into WebEOC, not at the volume that they were 10 weeks ago. Maryland's an unfortunate situation based on the execution of these emergency procurements. That material that has been ordered is flowing freely into the warehouses of the Maryland Department of Health. And that will continue and for a period of time. The department is shifting its strategy to deal with the phase two part of procurements, which will be more of a traditional invitation for bid and response by the community concerning the PPE and other medical equipment required for this emergency. So we're happy to turn to the second phase of our ordering strategy.
Could I ask about that, Mr. Secretary, for the second phase, we hope will not be as great as the first, but we don't know. Will the process, I'm concerned about things like MBE requirements and all the normal parts of state procurement. Will that be worked in more into this second phase?
It's an excellent question, Treasurer, and yes. So the procurement is almost ready for prime time. And our strategy is to, of course, have a state contract that any department can order off for their needs. And there will be two. There will be not only the baseline procurement, but there will also be the same procurement as an SDR, so that we capture as many vendors as possible and have a very diverse pool of vendors for state organizations to secure their products.
Great.
Good.
Madam Treasurer, I apologize. I missed your vote on the Lieutenant Governor's motion. I heard the Comptroller's second. The motion to remand A-19.
I vote aye.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Yes. Item A-17.
Item A-17 is a report by the State Board of Elections. We have Administrator Lamone as well as Deputy Administrator Charleston available by phone. That's Administrator Ms. Linda Lamone and Deputy Administrator Ms. Nikki Charleston.
Good morning. Linda Lamone, Administrator of Elections.
Good morning.
So this is the comptroller, and obviously we have already gone over the fact that the ballots that are being counted now had the incorrect date printed on them. There have been reports of that the information about drop-off locations were given to voters in a language other than their own language. There were reports about postage being required, reports about ballots being mailed late, ballots not being received at all, errors in reporting of results, so on and on. I guess, what is the situation now, Madam Administrator, with the election results, particularly in Baltimore City, but also around the state? There's some other races that I guess have not been fully reported, and I take it you put some results up, or someone put results up, and then took them down again. So, what's going on, I guess?
Well, let me just preface my answer with saying that this election indeed presented some unanticipated challenges, unprecedented challenges with the virus and having to plan for the election in the middle of the health situation. And the fact that people were basically confined to their homes for weeks at a time, unless they were essential. And then we had the horrible situation with George Floyd getting killed, murdered, and then the protest that followed that. I think while it was a tragedy about him, it really motivated a lot of people to get involved in the democratic process, which was a good thing. I'm sorry, did somebody ask me a question?
Yeah, the question is, you know, we got reports that some people actually showed up to vote in person and they were told that they'd already had an absentee ballot sent in. And they said, no, we didn't do it. So I guess there's some real concerns about security here and about, obviously, the election in November now is front and center. And I guess, do you have any thoughts as to what we're going to have to do in November to have a safe election that's a little less confusing and marred, I guess, by situations like what I just talked about? I mean, that is just, I assume if we have an in-person election in November, you're going to have the proper precautions, but we're talking about some long lines there, obviously, and some health issues. If we're not going to, if we're going to have a mail-in, frankly, that really causes me real concern, because this has not been smooth either a month ago or now.
Well, of course, the big difference is we have time to plan for November, whereas we had virtually no time to plan for the two elections that were held a month apart, all by mail, and something, frankly, that we had never done before. So we're going to do what we always do. We're going to look to see how we can make things better and work with the local boards of elections, as well as our friends and stakeholders in the community, to deliver the best election possible.
Can I just say, I understand what you're saying, but I'm not particularly, I don't feel comfortable with it, because I'm thinking back, and maybe Treasurer Kopp recalls her days when she ran for as a delegate. I was a delegate from District 20. When I made a mailing to, well, whatever it was, 4,000 or 5,000 voters, I used to literally visit the print shop and make sure it was printed. I followed it in my car over to the post office when they mailed it. I talked to the post office people about the need to get something out, that it can't just sit in the back room. But this was 3.5 million ballots that apparently
you were misinformed, had been printed and hadn't been printed, or had been sent but hadn't been sent? How can that? I just find that to be unbelievable. That and it is. It's not the first time. This is a more recent experience. That your team was not all over the vendors that you hired to make sure that there was no delay in delivering and mailing ballots.
Well, they were, and the vendors simply didn't tell us the truth, and I don't know how you overcome that.
Well, the vendors publicly disagreed with you.
The vendor publicly disagreed entirely with us, but excuse me. It was unfortunate. The candidates for mayor in Baltimore City had specifically asked us to delay the Baltimore City ballots for some time because they didn't want the voters in Congressional 7 District to get ballots for the city election right on top of the ballots they had just voted for the congressional race. So we did that, and that was, I'm not blaming them, but that was, you know, part of everything that was going on. We were trying to run the congressional election and also prepare for the presidential primary. And as I've said before, I'm really proud of the way everybody pitched in and helped and tried to make everything work as best they could.
Well, you heard the lieutenant governor at the beginning of this. I hesitate to ask for anybody's resignation, but I think it's time for some retirements and some new leadership, and particularly concerned about the fact that, you know, as competent as you are, Linda, and as, you know, your staff reveres you, there's something going on over there that is just completely unacceptable. And I actually would include in the suggestion for some retirement the Baltimore City director, I think it's Armstead Jones. I mean, we just need some new, fresh leadership now rather than come November.
Yeah, I agree. I said it earlier. I've lost faith. And I had said in previous board meetings going back to the 1st of April that I don't think that the thought process in terms of where the challenges could be. If the city is asking for a delay, and I said in the previous meeting, I received my ballot in Howard County 2 weeks after the special election. So the Baltimore City ballots could have been sent whenever my ballot was sent because it arrived 2 weeks after the special. There wouldn't have been any confusion. And I just, as the comptroller just stated with regard to any mailings, and I said that on the 1st, April 1st, that the concern is you're always going to have people who move. And it didn't seem as though there really was a lot of attention on that. The response initially was, well, we're getting information from motor vehicles. Well, on April 1st, the motor vehicle locations were closed. So that's not enough. People don't always change their addresses. There are a lot of people who vote at the precinct where they used to live. And so your information was going to be difficult. So there were some additional steps that needed to take place. I wasn't pleased with the PR firm that was hired. You know, there's a lot of talk about a politically connected or politically connected vendors on our emergency contracts, but these were politically connected PR firm, and no one's saying anything about that. So I have lost faith. I think it is time for some change, some new blood, some new thinking. I like the comptroller, rarely ask, you know, people to step down. But I just think it's time. We need to, you know, maybe it's just a new thought. You bring in a new coach from time to time, even a coach that can be doing relatively well. Sometimes it's just a little bit more to get the team over the hump and to be prepared for the new environment that we're in. I think mail-in voting is going to be here for, you know, for a long time. you know, until we get to online voting, which I think is something that's going to be the next step. So I you know, echo the words of the comptroller who was echoing my words, and just say thank you for your service.
Can I just say I'm not part of the echo, and I'm not prepared to tell the administrator to walk. But I am very concerned, as you know, about this next election, the lessons learned in the past in the special election, and then now in the primary. We have to understand what happened. I gather there were more people who showed up in person than anticipated. In retrospect, I hope we will not make that mistake. I agree with the Lieutenant Governor. I think there's going to be a lot by mail. I'm not so sure about electronic in terms of security.
At some point.
A lot by mail. We have to revamp and reorient our process. I'm not convinced, Linda, that you can't do that, that you're not the person to do that. I think to switch in midstream brings its own problems. But I do feel that in order for people to have faith and trust in the system, they have to understand more clearly exactly what is happening and what provisions are being made to assure a full, fair election. And unfortunately, that means repeating to us and to the public over and over again the same material, being open and transparent about problems, and just laying out what steps are being taken, what probably you say you found problems, but they've been addressed. Well, we have to know what problems and how they're addressed, and by whom, the sort of documentation, I guess, that you would expect an accounting office to be asking for. The public need to. These elections in November are going to be one of the most critical in the history of the United States of America. We can't mess them up. And I just... While I don't agree with the comptroller and the governor about who makes the decision, who goes and who stays, I do think that we need a complete new reorientation of the agency and of the Board of Elections and of the county boards to be focused with a laser-like intensity on making sure that these elections run smoothly and transparently, and people understand what the problems are. If you need more assistance, if you need more funds to do things correctly, then it's incumbent on you to tell us so. That's my position.
Any more questions on this agenda item or any of the others?
No, thank you.
Madam Treasurer, any more questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Move approval.
No. Second.
Okay, thank you, Secretary. Department of Natural Resources.
Hi, good morning, Governor and Madam Treasurer and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway Riccio, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We're seeking approval for 9 items on our real property agenda today, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
I wish we could find a problem.
I don't know, Jeannie, this is the simple thing. My staff is really good. I'll give them all the credit.
We can go through item by item and talk about the concession building at the Holly Avenue Rec Center and I will say, Madam Secretary, I think we are planning to do a park visit now that the parks are open. Is it next week or the week after that we're going down to Calvert Cliffs?
Yes, sir. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm going to restart my park tours. You all should go with us on some of these.
I would love to go.
We'll let you know.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's been wonderful. Because you just, for me, I didn't realize that we have, 75 parks?
75 state parks.
Yes.
In addition to our natural resources management areas and our wildlife management areas. So lots of opportunities for outdoor recreation in Maryland. And I'm happy to report that Maryland citizens are definitely taking advantage of that during these tough times. But we're happy to be able to host all of the visitors to our state parks and allow people to get their cabin fever and get some time outside during these hard times.
Yeah, get out in the fresh air.
Peter?
No, I'm going to defer and let you two go to the park. I will take a first-hand report, of course, and I just want to thank the secretary. You know, we never have real questions for you. You run a very tight ship. Congratulations to you and also, frankly, the administration for having you in charge.
Well, thank you all very much for your support. These projects are very meaningful to our local jurisdictions and to our state environmental goals, so we really appreciate the support that all three of you give our department.
Move approval.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Secretary. We're all in favor.
Thank you.
See you in about a week. Okay, university system.
Good morning. Jerry Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 5 items on the agenda. Here to answer any questions.
I just want to commend you on item 4C, the option small business reserve for A&E contract, and very appreciative. I was touting the university system, how they do a good job with the small business reserve, to one of the small business advocates just, I think it was last week, and was talking about how the university, along with State Highway, are kind of the stars in that area. I know DGS tries. I know Ellington's out there somewhere. But they do a very good job. And so, Joe, I want to thank you, particularly for this item, but generally the effort of the university system to work with the small businesses and utilize the Small Business Reserve Program.
I'll pass that on to College Park.
Okay.
Thank you. Governor, could I just point out, I have no problem with it, but item 1GM, Bowie State University, I think the comptroller would be interested to see if he didn't notice it. The J.E. Proctor building.
Right.
Chiller replacement. It's a chiller replacement. The important thing is the J.E. Proctor, who is our former, our late colleague and dear friend, Jim Proctor. And it's good to know that it's getting a new chiller. Great man, great university, and an excellent program in his building, too. I had a question about 3S, the University of Maryland Baltimore shuttle bus service, and just wondered what effort had been made to go to electric and how you all are going to meet your goals if you don't start doing that.
On this particular item, we are... contracted with the contractor to provide the actual buses, so it's a service. But we have done other things to lower the emissions.
Excuse me. The fact that it's a contract for service doesn't mean that one of the criteria can't be energy efficiency.
Yes, ma'am. I truly understand that, and. Honestly, I have to take full responsibility for that. This is my campus. I'm the procurement officer, and I was involved in this procurement, and I kind of focused on something on the ADA part of those buses. But like I said, I take full responsibility for the part of looking at alternative fuel vehicles and or electric vehicles, for this particular project. But on our campus, we have done other things to reduce emissions. In our garages now, we have 18 dual chargers in all of our garages, and that will service 36 vehicles. We are looking to put two additional chargers in each garage, but it's kind of been deferred at this moment. Our garages have 43 low-emission, fuel-efficient spaces, and that's in six of the seven garages. We instituted a, back in 2017, and I was involved in this, negotiated with Nissan Leaf for their electric vehicles. The program started in 2017 for faculty, staff, and students. There was like a $10,000 rebate for those people that would buy the Leaf vehicle. We had numerous people on campus that bought those vehicles. Our parking and transportation service, the ones that's managing this particular contract, they have a lightweight electric truck currently that they're using, and we've publicized that on our website. Our public safety currently has two electric motorcycles that are they're using in Baltimore City. We've got electric Segways, and we have two electric bicycles. And in addition to that, the vehicles that we're buying, although they're not electric yet, they're all flex fuel vehicles. And the majority of the vehicles that we purchase, we are purchasing off of the DGS contract. So we are trying to reduce the emissions from vehicles as it relates to the campus. But for the bus, and there are five of these buses, three that will be running over three routes and then back up in one optional for night. Again, like I said, I'll take responsibility for not looking at whether or not it could be electric.
You're a good man, Joe Evans.
Joe gave a lot more information than we were all prepared for.
But the Lieutenant Governor has pointed out often that one of the problems with going electric, one of the impediments is the lack of the infrastructure. So I think it actually is very important to know what you're doing, particularly in the garages, to enhance the infrastructure. That's good. Thank you.
That reminds me, and maybe I'll ask Ellington when we get to the DGS agenda. We had some discussions, Ellington and I had some discussions about DGS purchasing. I believe Ford now has an electric truck. They utilize pickup trucks down here in Annapolis. They have the facility to charge. And there was the possibility of being able to purchase it with some of the Volkswagen settlement money. So I just wanted to follow up. So be on alert, Ellington. I'm going to ask about that one. Any other questions on the university agenda?
Yes. Item 5S is a $4.5 million one-year renewal with Thompson Hospitality Services at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore for comprehensive dining services. It's a $4.5 million extension. This is what the university system seems to be doing a lot of, which is going to privatize dining services. We can raise that issue at other times, but I think I read that the systems institutions issued partial refunds for housing and dining plans that students prepaid at the beginning of last semester, which was canceled back in March. And I'm wondering, Mr. Vice President, whether the vendors refunded to the state services not rendered due to the unforeseen closure of the campuses back in March.
For this particular item, I would have to ask Lester Primus, who is the Vice President for Administration and Finance at University of Maryland Eastern Shore, to field that question.
Good morning.
Well, it's a generic question. I assume that the reports that the system granted partial refunds for housing and dining, that makes perfect sense. The question is whether these fixed contracts, like the one we're about to vote on, whether this is not concerning this contract because this is prospective, but retroactively, did these vendors that have these contracts refund to the state some of the payments where appropriate?
Yeah, and Mr. Comptroller, this is Lester Premier's Vice President of Finance Administration at UMES. It was not an automatic according to the contract, but we were able to negotiate with them at a lesser cost because of the early closure. So initially we received an outstanding invoice for services rendered, particularly between March 23rd, middle March, all the way up to the end of May 15th, which is according to the contract. When I received that, we did have a discussion. The vendor that we use is very understanding, and there were some savings that we obviously offset it because of the refunds that we have given to our students.
Because it appears as if the university systems, not just including you guys, are planning to open. It's going to be some kind of creative combination of in-person college education come September and remote classes, I'm told. And in an article by The Sun last Friday, it was reported the universities are working to reduce student density both in living spaces and dining halls. Most schools will prohibit or limit the use of kitchens, lounges, or other community spaces, while several institutions will offer grab-and-go dining options to allow social distancing in dining halls. I guess the question is just, once again, what you just mentioned. Are these contracts going to have an understanding that there should be refunds from the vendors if these kinds of changes are made?
Yes. Not only that, Mr. Comptroller, I have a meeting with our vendor sometime next week with our VP Enrollment Services, and we are going to talk about all of that.
Great. And I understand the students like the private concessions. So I'm not suggesting that. Sure. I'm just saying if things change, hopefully if their refund's appropriate that or lowered payments going forward appropriate, that would be recognized in good faith by everybody. It sounds like it is.
Yeah, so far it has. We've been having a good relationship with them, and as I mentioned earlier, with the early closing, we were able to renegotiate. And as I stated, that we are going to be meeting with our vendor at University of Maryland Eastern Shore to discuss all types of options and particularly looking at some of the contractual language with them. But so far, they've been very much understanding to the situation and been working with us.
Glad to hear that. Thank you.
However, I think the comptroller's original question was sort of system-wide and not just for this item. And I think we would be interested in general, Joe, not necessarily right now, to know how the system in its planning and then reflected in funding issue, financial issues, is dealing with the virus and changes in routine, like students being on campus part-time, not-time, changes in the use of, the buildings, 6 feet, people being 6 feet from each other, et cetera. What the impact is and how that's impacting financing. Is that...
I understand your question. I will get with system headquarters and... we will get an answer.
I think that's what you were asking.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad the treasurer's there, because otherwise half of my questions would go unanswered, I guess. Yeah. And I didn't even articulate it. She knows what I was concerned about. But it makes a lot of sense, Joe, obviously, system-wide, if they're, if depending, some of these contracts are long-term and not subject for review, so...
I think each one of the contracts would have to be looked at individually, see what kind of contract this language was in there when the contract was first negotiated. But like Vice President Prima said, a lot of the contractors are willing to work with you. I know on my campus, I've got one that's working with us now. Although we don't have a traditional dining facility, we do have grab and go, and they're shut down now, and we're working through that with that vendor.
Great. Look forward to that. Thank you, Madam Treasurer.
Governor, in general, at some point, not just because we're interested in higher education and
for a moment.
Not just because we... Yeah. And something else just popped up on my screen.
You're back, though.
It's my laptop. I apologize. I was to say, not just because we're interested in higher education, which we all are individually, but also because of the financial ramifications, particularly as we go into a very tough budget situation. I think it would be interesting for this board to know what the university sees as it looks out over the next 12, 18 months in terms of their finances and their programs. I know that the system administration is pulling together and going through things, trying to understand what the impact of the coronavirus will be on attendance and funding, tuition, costs, et cetera. At some point, and I suppose they would be the ones to know when it's the appropriate point when they have everything together, I think it would be useful to brief the Board of Public Works on this so we can understand as we look into the budget and look into revenue forecasts and look into cuts to understand how the Board of Regents is looking at this.
Yeah, we can. I can reach out to the Board of Regents and ask that they give us a date when they think they feel comfortable coming and talking to us about their projections, not what they're asking for per se in a budget, but
right.
Where they're projecting in terms of the, you know, attendance, revenue, decline, tuition, the room and board questions. So it'll be interesting to hear. And as I've mentioned a couple of times, I think they also need to be thinking in terms of, and particularly those who have the educational experience, what is the new world going to look like for education? Because people are getting, and younger people are getting very used to this remote education. And I read just, I want to say it was yesterday, an article in the Wall Street Journal about these engineering students who put together an app, which they did for somewhat good reasons, but it was in an article about how these kids are spoofing their instructors because they know how to do these things on Zoom. But these engineering students or computer science students had put together an app that made it seem that they were sitting in the classroom, in the virtual classroom, when they weren't. But the computer science student who created said, I didn't want to sit in an 8 o'clock class virtually, so what I would do is I created this so the professor thinks I'm there, but I watch the lecture at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's almost like our DVRs now that we watch our shows when we want to watch them. They're getting the lecture when they want to get it, versus when the professor is actually standing there. And I thought that was, you know, quite interesting, and it relates to something that Dr. Wilson at Morgan had told me about students who use YouTube to look to watch a lecture on the subject that they're currently studying because they can relate to the lecturer or he or she presents it in a way that they understand it better than the person who's standing in front of them in the classroom. So it really starts to change the whole, these professors almost become free agents, you know? It's going to be a really different world that, and may not be next year, but I think the universities, the education community has to start thinking about, you know, what's going to be the future of higher education.
Well, I'm sure they are thinking about it, and they're trying to make some plans, but it's a new world, you're right.
Yeah.
And it would be good to know where where they are in their thinking.
Right. There's the two parts. There's the here and now, the immediate, and then the long term. So.
Right.
Exactly.
Thank you. Any other questions for the university system? And I will check with the Board of Regents and talk to them about coming in and talking to us.
I would move approval.
Have a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you. Thank you,
Thank you.
Department of Transportation. Maryland Department of Transportation.
Good afternoon. How are you? Again, one minute after morning, so.
Good afternoon.
Good morning. Great to see everyone. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Greg Slater, Secretary of Maryland Department of Transportation. Before I get started, I've been enjoying the conversation about a variety of topics, but Madam Treasurer, you'd be interested to know that we just received a $3 million grant from FTA for some zero-emission buses for Baltimore City for MTA fleet. So we're going to be purchasing 3 60-foot zero-emission buses and be able to install some charging infrastructure with that grant as well. It'll give us the opportunity to try these vehicles downtown and be able to kind of make some progress before we make a bigger, larger type of a purchase and see how it works for us through this FTA grant.
Very good.
Very great. Always nice to do things with other people's money.
Absolutely. Well, we have a little bit of our skin in the game as well as part of the match, but it was a great opportunity. The Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 12 items for your consideration today, and we have representatives as well as myself here to answer any questions you may have.
I don't. Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller?
Yeah, I'd move approval. Yeah.
Second.
All right. Thank you. That was easy.
That was easy.
Okay. General services. Did we lose to the...
I am here. Good to see you again. This time, good afternoon, Governor and Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for the Maryland Department of General Services. Today, we are presenting 21 items for your consideration. And revisions have been submitted for items 8, 9, 10, and 18. And we have representatives available to answer your questions. And, Governor, I expect your questions, and we'll answer that accordingly at the time that you ask it.
Okay. I wanted to forewarn you. Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
On item 1C, it's a simple question. Any of these boiler repair operations are either MBE or SBR firms?
Governor, I can get back to the group.
If you don't have it in front of you, you can get back to me.
Yes.
Okay. And then I'm going to, if anyone has anything before we get to 18 IT, I had a, I can ask if anyone has any other questions on the agenda.
I did on item 17. This is a commissary contract modification.
Yes, item 17, and we do have Secretary Green from Public Safety to respond.
Okay, so I don't have any problem necessarily with this, but this has come before us eight times. This is the eighth time. We've given modifications on seven other occasions. I believe that the department has indicated that there is a new procurement out for this contract, and bids and proposals are due next Friday, June 15th. And I just want to confirm that this is the case and that we're going to have a competitive procurement process after all of this with a October, I think, date for a contract awardee. Is that still kind of the schedule?
Good afternoon, Governor. Mr. Comptroller and Madam Treasurer. That is correct. We're exercising the single six-month renewal. The contract went out to bid on April 1st. And as you noted, Mr. Comptroller, that is due on June 15th, and we anticipate a new contract before the board by October.
Excellent. And if I could, Lieutenant Governor, just pivot for a second to one of my current frustrations, which is the Corizon contract. I'm a little frustrated, and I think my staff is also. We thought this would be on this week's agenda with some clarification and responses to the issues that were raised at the last meeting, but here we are, and the item is not added back on the agenda. So I certainly hope that we can expect and anticipate the Corizon contract to be on the agenda for our June 17th meeting. I wonder if that makes sense to the secretary or the secretary.
Mr. Comptroller, you can anticipate that. We received a question as late as Monday evening, and we want to provide a full overview and a full a rendering to all of the questions this board has asked about that contract.
Great. We'll see you on the 17th. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor.
I guess I'm just looking at 18 IT. I've been seeing a lot of the project managers coming up, and I got. Yes, this is one specifically for MD Think, which is, I think is something I shouldn't say I think. I believe that this is something that will help us through the process and help us go forward. I don't really have a question. I'm just commenting that I think it's a good idea to make sure that we can get this going in the best manner. Mr. Secretary, on the potential Ford electric truck.
Yes.
We talked about that a little while ago. Has there been any progress on that?
Well, we have not moved to order, but we are evaluating all of our EV models in terms of small trucks and vans. And our Department of Facilities Management is very interested, especially since we have charging stations as part of our Annapolis complex. We're working with DBM concerning, that topic. In addition, I will just note that the department is also bidding and will be building, and with the help of our Office of Energy and Sustainability, more charging stations at least five sites across the state. So.
Well, I think that one of the items that popped up, and maybe Secretary Grumbles, I don't know if he's still on the line, but I was led to believe with the settlement with Volkswagen a while ago that there was some funding that could be utilized for both charging stations, but also for the acquisition of these vehicles. And that's why when I saw the Ford had issued this truck, and I don't want to just send everything to Ford per se, but just I saw that and I thought about your agency and also to a certain extent DNR, that those are two agencies that probably could utilize the electric pickups and really transportation as well, particularly since they've gotten away from that ugly yellow color on most of their vehicles. So.
Right. Absolutely. And the department is working with the Department of Budget and Management concerning that topic in terms of funding for vehicles that fit the definition.
Governor, it's my recollection that the Department of Budget and Management, in fact, put out a letter saying that electric vehicles should be the default, or energy-efficient vehicles should be the default, unless an explanation can be made why they shouldn't be used. And it's also my impression that the Secretary and the gentleman, the former police officer or trooper who's in charge of the vehicle program are quite enthusiastic about electric vehicles, or at least hybrid electric.
Right.
Electric and hybrid electric. But there's a feeling that sometimes the folks in the other agencies or in the bureaucracy are not as comfortable. They haven't had them. They're not sure that they're reliable, et cetera. So maybe, Mr. Secretary, you could work with the Secretary of DVM and try to reach out to, you know, the folks in the field and your fellow cabinet members and the Lieutenant Governor and get them all together pushing so that it's a group effort instead of individual silos or one department trying to bang on the others. Wouldn't that be helpful? Would that be helpful?
Well, a general conversation about strategy, of course, would be welcome. We will work with the Department of Budget and Management as they are the lead agency concerning this topic in any way that we can. And we will try to lead as we normally do by example.
That's great. Maryland should be in the forefront. We should be an example for the nation. And I'm sure that Secretary Brinkley and his staff will do everything they can to support you and bring folks together.
Madam Treasurer, on behalf of my grandkids, thank you for your leadership, because someday your efforts will be rewarded.
Thank you. There are many problems before us, but this one is not going away while we deal with the shorter-term crisis.
And we can talk about geothermal at another time, Mrs. Secretary.
Yes.
Cool. I look forward to it, Governor.
All right. Any other questions on General Services agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you all. Thank you very much for another riveting Board of Public Works meeting. Take care.
Pleasure. You too.
Thank you. Goodbye.
All right.